Lecture 9, Mother Ann Lee, the Religious Founder.
Religious innovation is one of the most distinctive aspects of the American identity. For 400 years, faith in unconventional religions has been a leading motive for migration to America. And for almost as long, new religions have been invented and developed here. Ann Lee, who was a near contemporary of Abigail Adams, was the principal figure in the creation of the Shakers. After years of persecution in England, persecution she brought on herself by deliberate provocation, she brought her closest followers to America in the hope that her strange new faith would win converts in the New World. After 6 years of neglect and adversity, her communitarian form of Christian millennialism began to attract New Englanders. Her premature death in 1784 could not prevent its spread in the following decades, even though its demand for absolute celibacy meant that nobody would ever be born to Shaker parents, and that recruits would have to accept and live a life of heroic self-discipline. Of all the people we're going to study in this course, Mother Ann Lee is the only one who never learned to read and write. All that we know of her was written by others. And even more than with most historical characters, it's sometimes necessary to be skeptical about the stories she inspired. Well, it's quite clear that radical Christianity transformed the life of poor, illiterate Ann Lees of Manchester. She was born in 1736, but wasn't baptized until 1742, when she was already six. Her father, John Lees, originally the family had the S on the name, although later it was dropped. Her father was a blacksmith. And she herself, as a child and as a teenager, worked in the clothing trades. This is in the town of Manchester, before the Industrial Revolution began. Later on, it was going to become a big centre for the importation and manufacture of American cotton fabrics. But there was already a small textile trade there in her childhood. And she worked in hand textile workshops. Now, the great event of her childhood was listening to the travelling evangelist George Whitfield. He's one of the most charismatic and magnetic figures in the religious history of the 18th century. He was a friend of John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, and himself, on both sides of the Atlantic, a very, very brilliant preacher. His preaching tours of North America in the 1740s had an absolutely galvanising effect upon thousands of American Christians. He was so popular that his crowds spilled out of churches, and he began to preach out of doors in a way which was then regarded as deeply unconventional, a little bit suspicious. But tens of thousands of people crammed into areas to see him, like Boston Common. There were examples of people being trampled as they tried to get close enough to him. Equally in England, he had a galvanising effect upon Christianity and waking up people whose faith had become conventional and sleepy. Benjamin Franklin himself, although he was also something of a sceptic, was so impressed by George Whitefield and was familiar with the way in which Whitefield could move people to, for example, give their money to him, that whenever Franklin went to listen to Whitefield, he didn't take any money with him. And he's got a very witty little passage in his autobiography about leaving his money at home, from knowledge that otherwise he'd hand it all over in the heat of the moment. Well, this had a big effect on Ann Lee as well. In 1758, she joined Jane and James Wardley's spiritual group, which was known as the Shaking Quakers. We don't know very much about this group, partly because written records are so scanty on it, but it seems to have been an offshoot of the Quakers, but perhaps with a mixture of Methodism. In those days, in the 1730s, 40s and 50s, the Methodists were much newer. This is Wesley's new idea, or the effects of Wesley's work. By then, the Quakers were already 100 years old and had to some extent settled into what we might call respectable middle age. But Methodism was still brand new and very vigorous. They also appear to have been influenced by French Calvinist refugees, the Camisards, who'd been expelled from France in 1685 by King Louis XIV. Now, both the Quakers and the Camisards, because they were religiously unconventional, were willing to accept the principle of female leadership, whereas throughout almost the whole history of Christianity, female leadership had been impossible. Like the Quakers, these early shaking Quakers had no definite liturgy, but instead depended upon the Holy Spirit spontaneously taking over their bodies, at which point they'd preach if they felt moved to do so. Certain American newspapers heard about this group before any of its members ever emigrated to the New World. Let me read you an account from the Virginia Gazette of 1769. This is one of those stories which the American press has picked up from English newspapers carried across by ship. Quote, "They converse until the moving of the Spirit comes upon them, which is first perceived by their beginning leisurely to scratch upon their thighs or other parts of their bodies. From that, the motion becomes gradually quicker and proceeds to trembling, shaking, and screeching in the most dreadful manner. At the same time, their features are not distinguishable by reason of the quick motion of their heads, which strange agitation at last ends in singing and dancing. These fits come upon them at certain intervals, and during the impulse of the spirit, they disturb the whole neighborhood for some considerable distance, and continues sometimes the whole night in the most shocking distortions and commotions until their strength is quite exhausted, from which uncommon mode of religious worship they have obtained the denomination of shakers." So here's a journalist describing the strangeness of this rapturous form of religious worship. When Ann Lee was 26, she married Abraham Standerin. He was a blacksmith, and they got married in Manchester Cathedral, the Anglican cathedral there. Abraham Standerin was her father's apprentice, an apprentice blacksmith, and as far as we can tell, it was an alliance of economic convenience rather than a love match. It was quite common for the apprentice to marry the boss's daughter to keep the trade inside the family and to maximize economic convenience and security. Neither of them could read or write, and so they marked the marriage register simply with crosses signifying their assent. Now, in the following 4 years, she gave birth to 4 children, but all of them died, which she interpreted as being a judgment on her sinfulness. I mentioned last time, talking about Abigail Adams, that death in childbirth and the death of children very soon after childbirth was extremely common in the 18th century. But the lesson she drew from this experience was that, just as the sexual joining of Adam and Eve had separated man from God back in the Garden of Eden, so abstinence from sex was the route to reunification of humanity with God. And from that time on, she began to preach a form of fanatical self-denial and asceticism. Complete abstinence from sex, and also eating and drinking so little that she almost wasted away, almost died of what we would call anorexia. She had an absolute horror of falling asleep because she became convinced that she'd fall asleep and wake up in hell. And we have stories about her holding her eyes open to try to prevent herself from sleeping. She had vivid dreams when she did sleep and visions of wrestling with dragons. Her dreams also borrowed very heavily from the imagery in the book of Revelation, the prophetic last book of the New Testament, which later on she believed that she herself had fulfilled. Now, psychoanalysts who've studied Mother Ann Lee speculate that she was actually a very sensually inclined person, that she had a disposition in favor of sex and eating and so on, and overcompensated in her rejection of both of them as she began to interpret them as the fruits of sin. This experience intensified her commitment to the group. She converted her father, her brother, and her sister. Although her husband went along. He appears to have been a much weaker character than she, and went along, but never wholeheartedly. She became clearly the leader of the group, and insisted that all the members confess their carnality, in other words, confess that they had sexual inclinations, and then make a pledge of absolute celibacy. And finally, she reached the logical end point of this train of thought in coming to believe that she represented the second coming of Christ, foreseen in some of the scriptures. She said, or she's recorded as having said, "I feel the blood of Christ running through my soul and body. I feel him present with me as sensibly as I feel my hands together. It is not I that speak, it is Christ who dwells in me. And she now believed herself to be divinely protected. As you can imagine, many people living around her were shocked at what seemed to them the blasphemy of somebody claiming to be the second coming of Christ, especially a humble clothing trades worker in Manchester. And she was periodically assaulted. She was attacked by her brother, for example, with a broomstick, and he beat her with it until it splintered. But she said she was divinely protected, and it had done her no harm at all. Later on, she was stoned by a group whose missiles could not actually touch her, or that's the way in which the story comes to us. Incidentally, one of the great problems for a historian in studying stories like this is deciding how do you deal with miracles. Most historians are deeply skeptical people, and they think that miracles don't happen. On the other hand, we've got lots of historical accounts from this and from many other periods of people who do seem to have been involved in miraculous events. A little bit later on in the course, we'll be talking about the early Mormons. I'll be talking about Brigham Young. Brigham Young certainly did believe that Joseph Smith had been visited by an angel, and that the angel had brought him some tablets on which were written in a mysterious language the words which were translated into the Book of Mormon. Later on in the 19th century, Saint Bernadette at Lourdes believed that she'd seen visions of the Virgin Mary, and that a spring had come up where none had come previously. You can take the view that we merely regard these as interesting psychological phenomena, but sometimes there are actual physical implications like the spring itself or the book itself. Or you can take the view that we simply have to abstain from certain knowledge and admit that we don't know. Mother Ann Lee also claimed that she'd got the gift of tongues, that she could speak 12 languages perfectly, even though she'd never learned any of them. Well, she rose to leadership of the Manchester Shakers and suffered persecution, partly because of what looked like this blasphemous claim to be the re-embodiment of Christ, and partly through deliberate provocation. Her group denounced all other forms of Christianity, and sometimes they'd go into the Anglican services on Sunday mornings to deliberately disrupt them, because they thought of Anglicanism, which was the religion of the state church, as being corrupt. When she was in prison after being arrested during one of these incidents, she enjoyed a vision of her future in America. In 1774, another member of the group, James Whittaker, also saw a vision of America as a brightly shining tree, which he said represented the Church of Christ. Now that, coupled with the great political ferment which was then taking place in America, the first days of the Continental Congress and the beginnings of the independence movement, led Ann Lee herself and James Whittaker and some of their other members to believe that the millennial future lay not in England, but in America. And that's what fueled their decision to emigrate. So in 1774, funded by a sympathetic member of the group called John Hocknall, the leading members of the Shaking Quakers emigrated to America. Ann Lee herself was then 38 years old. At first, arriving in America with very, very few resources, they simply had to get working-class jobs. And at first, Ann Lee herself worked as a servant in New York City, and her husband carried on plying his trade as a blacksmith. As I mentioned earlier, he'd never been completely convinced that his wife really was the re-embodiment of Christ, and after a bout of rather severe illness, declared that he rejected her principle of celibacy and left her, and that's the last we hear of him in the historical record. But Hocknall, this more prosperous member who'd financed the group's migration in the first place, remained absolutely convinced. And he gave the money for the group to buy an estate northwest of Albany, New York, at a place called Watervliet, where the group then concentrated and settled, living together. They practiced communal living there, celibate communal living. Now, with the beginning of the Revolutionary War, there was a terrific amount of religious ferment, particularly in northern New England and in upstate New York. The historian Steve Marini, who's done a lot of excellent work on this area, says this is a period where millennial sects were bubbling up continuously. People who believe that the revolution wasn't merely a political event, but was actually the harbinger of the end of the world, or the harbinger of the return of Christ. people there, charismatic religious leaders, denied the reality of death, denied the authority of the established churches. Of course, the political upheavals of the revolution, just like the political upheavals of the English Civil Wars back in the 1640s, which we studied earlier, had profound religious consequences as well. And the whole area had been prepared by what was called the Great Awakening. The revival tours of George Whitefield and other itinerant preachers in the 1740s and 50s had intensified the emotionality of religion there. New England religion had always had an emotional component, but in the days of Cotton Mather, it had also been fiercely intellectual. If anything, the emotional component of it is intensifying at this period. Now, the arrival of this group of English visionaries, because they were pacifists and because they were English, they were suspected of being loyalists. So at first they found it very difficult to win the trust of the people into whose company they'd moved. And they were suspected of being on the side of the Tories, the Redcoats. And so Lee and some of the other leaders were imprisoned again at Albany Old Fort. But while she was in prison in Albany, she preached and made converts inside the prison. I can't stress too strongly how magnetic her own personality was. And gradually the word began to spread about her charismatic presence and her strange beliefs. Another event which had a galvanizing effect upon the whole environment was the so-called Dark Day. This was May the 19th, 1780, a day when the sun never rose, and the whole day, the whole of upstate New York and New England remained dark. This is a great meteorological puzzle. There was a very, very strong smell of smoke, which religious millennialists interpreted as being apocalyptic or demonic. I mean, practical historians have said, no, actually, it's because there was a lot of forest fires. And what we've really got is a lot of smoke in the atmosphere, which gives the appearance that the day has never really started properly. But certainly it had the effect of causing religious millennialists in the area to believe that here's was a further sign, an augury of the second coming. When she was out of prison, Anne Lee realized that what she and her followers ought to do was to encourage people to come and visit them and to watch them conducting their rituals in the belief that their sincerity would have the effect of winning converts. Everyone who came to visit was also fed and accommodated without being charged anything. They were very welcoming to people who wanted to come to watch. Now, James Whittaker, who'd had the first American vision, and Anne Lee's brother, William Lee, were elders. They also enjoyed ecstatic and charismatic communication directly with God. Everyone who came to visit them and decided to join the group, had to confess to Anne Lee or one of these two men, the elders, about all the sins which made up the content of their lives up to that point. And of course, many people arrived skeptical. They'd heard about this visionary and they said, oh, we're not going to be taken in by a thing like that. Obviously, it's a fraud. But when they got there, and when they witnessed the dancing, and when they met Anne Lee, their souls were strangely moved and changed. Let me read you the testimony of a couple of them. Here's Jemima Blanchard. Quote, she turned and looked at me with such a pleasant, heavenly countenance that it absorbed my whole soul. She took me by the arm and said, wilt thou be a daughter of Zion and be searched as Jerusalem with candles? I answered not, for I knew not what to say. Her words seemed to me like the voice of God. When Anne Lee suggested that she confess her sins, she found herself completely unable to resist the idea. Quote, in an instant her arms were around my waist and we were both on our knees. I shook so that the windows clattered, but I did not know what it was for some minutes. After this, I thought no more about going home, being exercised almost constantly by the power of God for many days, as the testimony of a convert who comes skeptical but stays. Here's another recruit, a man named Thankful Brace. Quote, her eyes were shut, and it appeared that her sense was withdrawn from the things of time. She sang very melodiously and appeared very beautiful. The graceful motion of her hands, the beautiful appearance of her countenance, and the heavenly melody of her voice made her seem like a glorious inhabitant of the heavenly world, singing praises to God. As I sat by the side of her, one of her hands, while in motion, frequently touched my arm, and at every touch of her hand, I instantly felt the power of God run through my whole body. Well, these two and many other recruits made their confessions and were told that they must now give up sexuality for the rest of their lives and gladly consented. Anne Lee told one recruit, "The marriage of the flesh is a covenant with death and an agreement with hell. If you want to marry, you may marry the Lord Jesus Christ." Now, I don't mean to imply that every witness was instantly convinced and converted to Shakerism. Obviously, it never attracted more than a small and very interesting minority. But everyone who went to see them agreed that their form of ritual was itself a very astonishing and engrossing thing. Here's an army doctor from the Continental Army who witnessed them in 1778. Quote, "They spend whole nights in their revels. Both sexes, nearly divested of clothing, fall to dancing in extravagant postures and frequently whirl themselves round on one leg with inconceivable rapidity until they fall apparently lifeless on the floor." Another observer agreed, describing the progressive exhaustion which this dancing brought on until, quote, "Several of the young people, both men and women, began to shake and tremble in the most terrible manner. The first I perceived was their heads moving slowly from one shoulder to the other. The longer they moved, the quicker and more violently they shook. The motion proceeded from head to the hands, arms, and whole body, with such power as if limb would rend from limb. The house trembled as if there were an earthquake." Now, as I say, some of these skeptics went away unconvinced, fascinated but unconvinced, and said, "They're not really celibate. They're really deeply promiscuous. And what's going on in these exercises is that they're really the preludes to an orgy." But they don't, of course, they don't let us see that. Accusations were made against them of drunkenness. This is very, very common in the history of new religions. Their critics nearly always discountenance them by saying, well, they're drunks, they're promiscuous, and so on. But it's also true that stories of Mother Anne Lee's power as a miraculous faith healer spread throughout New England and upstate New York. The Shakers enjoyed a lot of recruiting success in the last years of Anne Lee's life, particularly between 1781 and Anne Lee's death in 1784, when they went on a long recruiting tour through New England. But unlike George Whitefield, who'd moved constantly from one town to the next, preaching and then moving on quickly, the Shakers' method was to settle for a while in each of several small towns, and while they were there, create an ideal model community and gather people around them, who then became the nucleus of new Shaker settlements. One of the places where they had particular success was in the little town of Harvard, Massachusetts. Not the place where Harvard University is, but Harvard, which is inland in Massachusetts. And it became a second centre for the group after Watervliet. When she arrived there, looking around, she said, this is a place which I saw previously in a vision. And it already had a history of millennial religious expectation, because a man who'd lived there until then was named Shadrach Ireland. He'd been the charismatic leader of a small group who'd believed that he could not die, that during his own lifetime the world would come to an end, and that he'd be transported into Jesus' presence without the intervention of death. But he did die, and in the moments before his death, he told the group, "Don't bury me, because in a few days Jesus will come back and the burial will be totally unnecessary." So the group, loyal to his requests, put his body in the basement and sort of packed him in lime in the hope of retarding the decay process. But after about a year, there was absolutely no question that that Shadrach Ireland really was deteriorating rather severely. And finally, and reluctantly, they buried him. So quite a lot of his recruits now switched over to the Shakers and joined Mother Anne Lee, who's a sort of slightly more plausible new successor. She moved into the house where his group had lived and declared, quote, "God has a people in this place. He has heard their cries. They have had great light." Stephen Marini calls this residential evangelism. In other words, the opposite of itinerant evangelism. Families were often converted in a group, and they'd come in and join the community, the residential community, where everything was shared together. And so many people visited them as the word about them spread, that they had to set up a farming commune and workshops so they could feed and provide the hospitality, which was one of the attractions they offered. In the early days, as I mentioned earlier, critics continued to think that they were really British spies and periodically tried to beat them out of town altogether. And interestingly, some of the criticism of them was that they were really Catholics in disguise. It is true that they had very strongly developed principles of celibacy, like the priests and nuns. It is true that they had the principle of confession, which obviously is also a Catholic sacrament. And they also exhibited unquestioning obedience to a leader, which you might see as a parallel to obedience to the Pope. It was a grotesquely wrong accusation, of course, because they're right at the what we might call the militant end of the Protestant spectrum. But nevertheless, the allegation was sometimes made. Another of the strange accusations made of Mother Anne Lee was that she was really a British spy, a man disguised as a woman. Here's an account of how she was once searched and seized to try to establish that point. Quote, "They immediately seized her by the feet and inhumanly dragged her feet foremost out of the house and threw her into a sleigh with as little ceremony as they would the dead carcass of a beast and drove off, committing at the same time acts of inhumanity and indecency which even savages would be ashamed of. In the struggle with these inhuman wretches, she lost her cap and handkerchief, and otherwise had her clothes torn in a most shameful manner. Their pretense was to find out whether she was a woman or not." Well, in other words, I think in a roundabout way they're saying they're investigating her genitals to see whether she was a man or a woman. She converted James Meacham, who was a local Baptist preacher and already established a reputation in the area for powerful oratory. And that itself had the effect of spreading the Shaker gospel because he himself had attracted many interested recruits. She described him as her, quote, her firstborn in America. And he was going to become the leader of the Shakers after her death in 1784. She reassured him that she was not trying to revolutionize gender relations, despite her insistence on celibacy. And she continued to say that people who were already married when they became Shakers, should continue the tradition of wifely submission to the husband. Quote, "As the order of nature requires a man and a woman to produce offspring, so where they both stand in their proper order, the man is the first and the woman the second in the government of the family. But when the man is gone, the right of government belongs to the woman. So it is in the family of Christ. In other words, she's become the guardian of the Holy Family because Jesus is no longer present here on earth. She's the fulfillment of the second half of the Holy Family." Well, as I say, she died unexpectedly in 1784 at the age of 48, just a few weeks after the death of her brother, Elder William Lee, who was her first convert and her closest spiritual partner. On her deathbed, she described a vision of him, her brother, coming from heaven in a chariot to bring her home. The surviving elder, James Whittaker, moved the group to New Lebanon, New York, which became one of the Shaker settlements, and helped it to adapt to new circumstances. It was he whose vision had first led the group to move to America. And if anything, the group intensified its separatism, its removal out of ordinary society, and its commitment to asceticism and from sexuality. Shakerism, under his leadership, and under the leadership of James Meacham, who I mentioned a second ago, Shakerism continued to spread, creating a highly idealized memory of Anne Lee. She was remembered in the group as the person who had completed Jesus' work. He'd created spiritual perfection, they said, and she matched it with a life of physical perfection, permitting reunion with God. Let me read you a couple of verses from a Shaker hymn which was written in 1813, which reasserts the principle of God's double gender. Here it goes. "Long ere this fleeting world began, or dust was fashioned into man, there power and wisdom we can view, names of the everlasting two. The Father's high eternal throne was never filled by one alone. There wisdom holds the mother's seat and is the Father's helper meet." Okay, the dual gender of God, Jesus and Mother Anne Lee. Well, upstate New York, the place where she'd worked, later on it took on the name of the Burned Over District, partly because it had literally been burned but with land clearance, but partly because it was burned in repeated religious revivals in the Second Great Awakening, the period immediately after the Revolution, when one after the next millennial sects bubbled up there. A lot of the most noteworthy American-founded religions originate there. The Mormons in the 1820s, the Millerites, the people who believed that they could actually timetable Jesus' second coming, and who in 1844 gave up all their possessions and climbed a hill to wait for Jesus to come down. And the Oneida Perfectionists, another group which practiced what were regarded in the day as scandalously unconventional sexual customs. Belief in the human perfectibility and the imminent end of the world have continued to inspire religious founders in America right down to recent times. Later on, the Jehovah's Witnesses, the Christian Scientists, even groups like Jim Jones's The People's Temple in the 1960s and 70s. To visitors abroad like me, there's almost nothing more striking about America than its incredible religious vitality and its great religious diversity. These are among some of the very strongest elements of the American identity. And as the example of Mother Ann Lee shows us, it's always been a place susceptible to and receptive of new religious experiments.